B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, April 13th, 2020. By the way, I wanted to mention that to kind of divert myself on Sunday evenings, I've started a little DJ party on Sunday nights on Facebook. And if you want to join in the fun, all you got to do is hit me up with a friend request on your Facebook thing. So today, we observe that Sunday, Easter, was the day that the corporate media outlets chose to start coverage of the, I believe, somewhat credible charges put forward by a former Biden Senate staffer named Tara Reid that Joe Biden sexually assaulted her in a Capitol nook in 1993. Now, there are a number of curiosities about the timing of this. Is it because Bernie Sanders is out of the way and they want to kind of inoculate the public on these charges in an effort to dismiss them and promote the candidacy of Joe Biden, who I consider to be very weak and vulnerable against Trump? And it was interesting because, as you may know, I subscribe to the New York Times, but just 3 days a week for home delivery. And the Sunday paper is chock full of stuff. Now, when I woke up yesterday morning, I saw a posting about this report in the New York Times. And I said, oh, well, when I get to the paper, it'll be there. But I read through the news section and the opinion section and the style section and looked at the magazine, and it wasn't there. And so it will appear in today's print edition of the New York Times, which has far lower circulation than the Sunday paper. And, fascinatingly, they were joined by the Washington Post, which says they have been investigating this for 3 weeks, but chose the Sunday after Bernie Sanders withdrew to publish in some sort of accidental synchrony with the New York Times. Then you pop on NBC, and suddenly, in between the pandemic coverage, the main NBC network and MSNBC have decided that the time is right to surface these allegations brought by Tara Reid. And I cannot prove any complicity, any back-channel communication, but it is somewhat bizarre because we have been reporting on this for over a month since Tara Reid, who lives up in Nevada County, which is east of Sacramento in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, surfaced a revised version of her story. She said last year that Biden had touched her in a creepy and inappropriate way at different times. But she was immediately smeared as some sort of a Russia apologist because, totally unrelated, she had posted some comments that were viewed as favorable to Putin. She now has withdrawn those statements and says she was naive. I actually haven't read those. But after she saw former Nevada legislator Lucy Flores smeared in the media for joining five or six other women and saying, you know, Joe touched my hair, my shoulders, and gave me a little rub and sniffed my hair and said how beautiful I was. And so Tara Reid did expand her claims. And you can judge that one way or the other. It is an issue that, may undermine her credibility. But the reporting in both the Post and the Times is pretty similar. And it includes ritual denials from the current campaign staff of Joe Biden. Also from Ted Kaufman, who was a chief of staff to Biden. And when Biden was elevated to the vice presidency, Kaufman was the interim senator from Delaware. He owes Joe. But what is interesting is she did make real-time reports to her mother, and her brother has clarified that he heard the specific allegation that Joe molested her with his finger in real time. And the other interesting thing is that these accounts, number one, say that since they've started talking with her, and both the Post and the Times said they had at least two lengthy interviews with Ms. Reed, but a week or two apart, and they said her story is strikingly consistent. And the other thing that they report that is new is that she says the incident occurred probably in April of 93, and by August, she had essentially been demoted. She had been the person in charge of the interns in Biden's Senate office. Those duties were taken away from her. She was given a windowless office. And then she was given a month to move on, to try to find another job inside the Capitol, which she did not succeed at, or maybe she chose not to, I'm not sure. In any event, she never worked in Washington again. And so you can build a case that her allegations are at least as credible as those of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, who talked about high school antics with now Supreme Court Justice for Life, Brett Kavanaugh. The guy who testified under oath, his most credible statement was, "I like beer." The rest of it was really shaky, and his phony outrage really channeled Clarence Thomas, who Joe Biden didn't have the courage to come out and say, "Mr. Thomas, you're not qualified to sit on the U.S. Supreme Court," after President Poppy Bush had said he was the most qualified man in the United States for the job. And let me be really clear here. I find Tara Reid's charges credible. I am not in a position to prove or disprove them. But she has little to gain. She's not selling a book. She doesn't have a Tiger Hunt Netflix series coming up. And she's going to pay a price for coming forward with these allegations. But the fact that she was relieved of duties and then shuffled out of Biden's office in short order after she has reported that she refused his advances, and he said, "You're nothing to me," I think those buttress her claims. As I've already pointed out, the timing of this delayed coverage for the purpose of dismissing her claims, I think, is questionable. And of course, because Bernie Sanders is such a good friend of Joe Biden, and we'll get to it later, he gave a fuller endorsement of Biden today. He would never take up a claim like this and even say, "Joe, my good friend, even if this isn't true, this is going to be used to damage you by the Trump team." And it just adds to the caboose full of baggage that you bring to this campaign? No. This will not be contested. And the Democrats who are backing Biden, some with great regret, are going to enter a bubble now and just try to ignore this, try to wish it away, say that it's opportunist, it's campaign smear fodder. But Trump's people won't let it go away. And together with the Ukraine scandal, which many Democrats, think showed that Joe and Hunter did nothing wrong, we know that that's going to be trotted out by the Trump campaign and allies of the same. And so consider the source here. The Gateway Pundit is a far-right, Washington-based media website. And what the Gateway Pundit reported, and this is dated, right, 2017, should properly be categorized as gossip. And I share this with you not because I believe it all, but because this is the kind of stuff that gets to Breitbart, gets to Drudge, gets to Fox, gets to Rush, and they will use it to divert people from Trump's own very clear record as a serial sexual predator. So this is gossip based on anonymous, alleged Secret Service agents who covered Joe Biden as his protective team. One agent, "We had to cancel the VP Christmas get-together at the vice president's house because Biden would grope all of our wives' and girlfriends' asses." And in one case, a Secret Service agent reportedly got suspended for a week in 2009 for shoving Biden after the vice president cupped his girlfriend's breast while the couple was taking a photo with him. And they produce a photo of a completely different woman who is pushing Biden's hands down toward her tummy and away from her breasts. Now, this material is going to be out there. It's going to be amplified. They also report that Biden would saunter around the Naval Observatory, the home that the vice president gets to live in for free, without any clothes on. Now, let me say, this may be way too much information for you, my loyal listeners, that I don't wear pajamas. In the winter, if it's really chilly, I might put on a t-shirt. But our bed's warm enough that I do not require additional clothing. And it can be embarrassing when something happens in the middle of the night and I bound out of bed, but I don't have a Secret Service detail. They also report that Joe Biden has a pool at his home in Delaware, and that when Jill isn't around, he will swim in the nude even when there are female agents in his protective detail. So, I share this with you again, not because I believe it all or that I want to promote it, but this is going to be out there. And for the mainstream media organs to coordinate the date that they decide finally to cover Tara Reid's charges after Bernie is safely out of the way, well, it's kind of stinky. At least, that's how it sniffs out to me. I want to commend Consortium News and its editor-in-chief, Joe Lauria. They've been reporting in detail on the extradition process against Julian Assange in London, the cruel judge, Vanessa Beretzer, who last week denied him bail and then exposed some of the information in his bail application. Such as, well, I have a partner and two kids here in London, and that's where I'll be staying. Judge Beretzer then revealed the identity of the mother of Assange's two young children. And her name is Stella Morris. The kids, Gabriel and Max, appear in this video. And what's fascinating to me is that Consortium News puts it in the proper context, that this video is being released because the judge revealed the identity of a woman who worked for WikiLeaks and apparently, she says, fell in love with Assange while he was holed up in the Embassy of Ecuador in London. And now that we know the surveillance that was present there, they were making babies while the Spanish intelligence firm that fed the videos and other surveillance footage to the CIA, oh, their eyes were wide open. And I have an account that was published in my San Francisco Chronicle today from the Associated Press. And they just kind of report matter-of-factly that Stella Morris, they spell her last name with one R, Consortium News spells it with two. But they do not note. They give the origin. Here, let me read. Morris said in a statement last month in support of Assange's bail application that she'd gone to great lengths to shelter our children from the climate that surrounds him. Assange respected her wish for privacy, but there is no context here about how Judge Baratzer had decided to make public the identity of Stella Morris, which puts her at risk, and she probably figured, well, it's better to put out the truth than to have it spun by the forces arrayed against Julian Assange. And so I recommend that you watch the video. It's touching in many ways. There's one other video I want to recommend to you that I watched over the weekend. It's an interview of Ed Snowden, conducted by Shane Smith, who is the founder and businessman who runs Vice News. And I've seen Shane Smith interviews before, and his fawning interview of Barack Obama goes back a few years. But he bigfooted some of the great reporters that he hired for Vice News and insisted on the ego gratification of doing that interview himself. Well, his interview with Snowden is much better. We don't see some grandstanding by Shane Smith, and he allows Snowden to speak honestly about the risks to expanded surveillance, especially the kind of contact tracing by cell phone that has been floated in recent days. So I recommend that video to you. And I want to pause for a moment to once again explain the Peter B. Collins Podcast Community Fund. I have seeded it with my $1,200 loan, if I ever get it from the government. And for the next 60 days, all subscription income will go into the fund. Non-subscribers and subscribers are asked to give if you want to either make a contribution or add to your contributions to this podcast. And we will acknowledge your contributions unless you ask to remain anonymous. We'll be giving out grants of $100, one per household. We'll be liberal, but we request that you explain what expense that you are facing, rent, groceries, a car payment. And tell us what the total need is. We can only give you $100, but our listeners might be moved to contribute even more. So if you have a request, email Peter at peterbcollins.com. If you want to make a contribution, use PayPal. Link to that same address, Peter at peterbcollins.com. Allergic to PayPal, that's fine. You can mail a contribution or a request to Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California, 94915. It applies around the globe. We're not limiting it to the United States. And explain, if you're going to apply for a grant, let me know if you don't use or have access to PayPal, and we will arrange to mail you a check if possible. So we've got an endorsement from a longtime contributor, Jerry in Southeast Portland. Peter, just writing to thank you for starting your own version of a COVID relief fund. As a monthly contributor, I wholeheartedly endorse this generous endeavor of yours. The Peter B. community and your seed money may provide real relief to people in need. I think it's also regenerative to us donors. It feels good to know that in some small way we're helping others in need. Thanks again, and all the best to you and all. And so I got a fascinating request yesterday. And let me explain that this is a whistleblower who made important contributions when we helped reveal the Stingray surveillance system almost 5 years ago. And I want to credit the independent journalist Bo Hodai, who first did the detailed work to expose the Harris Corporation's surveillance device that mimics a cell phone tower, requires all nearby phones to check in with it, and is capable of grabbing all kinds of data from your phone, not the least of which your current location. So, at that time, this person reached out to me, and to maintain some anonymity, I assigned her the name Benny. And Benny has been my mythical NSA listener. I developed that idea a long time ago just to kind of personalize the surveillance that I suspect continues to this day. And so her real name is Jessica. And when I first heard from her, she was living in the Portland, Oregon area. She's now relocated to the Midwest. She said, I heard about your financial assistance. I'm hoping I could inquire. I have not worked for 3 years due to complex medical issues. and when it rains, it pours. I have a dear service cat that needs surgery, and I was hoping to see if you had any listeners that might be open to assistance, if you happen to have any feline lovers in your audience. And she sent me some pictures of her beautiful cat, and she described that it is a rare breed that is kind of like a dog and is her real companion and sustenance. And the cat, the kitty, needs surgery that could cost up to $2,000. So I am awarding a grant to Jessica today, and if you are so moved, get in touch with me, and you could earmark a contribution that we can put toward her kitty fund, her kitty, to try to reduce the cost to her, or maybe even pay for it all, so that she can maintain her strong relationship with this important little creature. I also want to note that Roxane Gay, who is an author, she called herself a bad feminist. She appeared on Trevor Noah's Daily Show last week, and she's doing something similar. She just said, if you need money, send me an email. And she's sending out payments of $100 as well. So if you are in need, you can only get $100 from me. That's all I'm capable of giving an individual. But Roxane Gay, R-O-X-A-N-E, may be a resource for you. Now to our daily coronavirus update compiled by Linda Lewis. Worldwide, the current number of confirmed cases is just approaching 2 million and 118,000 deaths. Here in the United States, confirmed cases are over 500,000, edging up toward 600,000, with 23,000 deaths. Boris Johnson is recovering at his country residence. He thanked the socialist medicine experts at the National Health Service for saving his life. European countries have seen steep rises in cases and deaths, but slowing infection rates, and that is a trend that's occurring in New York as well. Italy has the highest toll outside the U.S., 20,000 deaths so far. Recent data suggesting the infection rate is slowing. Spain's death toll is at 17,500, the third highest of any country, and 170,000 confirmed cases, but the rate of new cases is declining. In Japan, the island of Hokkaido is implementing a new round of restrictions after a second wave of infections followed the relaxation of the first round. And I don't have the details on the numbers, but four new cases were confirmed on April 7th, and then that tripled within 5 days. So I think that is, an indication that letting up too soon could cause a new multiplication of reported cases. In South Korea, a report on Friday, 91 patients cleared of the new virus have tested positive again. And there's speculation from the health officials there that the virus may have been reactivated rather than the patients being reinfected. But I think that indicates that there's a lot we don't know, a lot of known unknowns about the presumed path of the virus. Trump is now threatening, after he said he wouldn't, after he said he would, to cut U.S. funding to the World Health Organization. And this is another America First move that is not likely based on solid data, but just Trump's feeling that the WHO is too China-centric. All 50 states here in the U.S. now under disaster declarations, but still the stay-at-home orders, I believe, are in force in somewhere near 40 states. Now, yesterday, Trump retweeted comments from a Republican who got 2% in the San Francisco primary when she challenged Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And she had said that Fauci's got to go. That's the simple summary. And she used the hashtag #FireFauci. Now, the White House today is saying, oh, he just retweeted that. He's not going to fire Fauci. That's fake news. And I believe this was another presidential fake to try to embarrass the media. other tweets. Do we? Do I need to know about them? He attacked Fox News anchor Chris Wallace. And Trump has been accused of third-grade name-calling for his trouble. Well, that's fair. On Friday, he said, some of your allies have been bashing these doctors. Some of your allies have been bashing. You know that? Trump interrupts. Some of your allies have been bashing these doctors. Would you tell them to cut it out? And he just offered a bland endorsement. I have great respect for these people. Now, there's a lot of discussion about how and when to so-called reopen the country. And it's going to be very challenging. And people like me reject the use of cell data, the idea that people who test negative can be given a card or some sort of, maybe a digital watermark that they carry around. And this gets chilling. The idea of a police state tactic to decide who can and can't work, who can and cannot travel. And with this guy in charge, we can't expect a solution that respects our privacy. And Trump is arguing that governors don't get to decide when they so-called reopen and end or ease the restrictions. And he confuses people because in one breath he says that it's his decision. And then in the next he says, pretty much the governors he likes can make moves, but he has to approve of them. Now, this is the guy who has refused any coordinated national response in the distribution of badly needed medical supplies, even as he asserts more dictatorial power. And as Linda observes in her notes here, Republicans have a consistent practice of calling for states' rights when it's in their narrow interest. But if it's something about legalization of marijuana or the right to die, they feel quite comfortable intervening. And Mike DeWine, a hardline conservative Republican and now governor of Ohio, quoted here, wherever we open up, however we do it, if people aren't confident, if they don't think they're safe, they're not going to go to restaurants, they're not going to bars, they're not really going to get back into society. And that does, I think, reveal the challenges that we're facing. Robert Redfield, who is the head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said on TV this morning that early case identification of the virus will allow for swift isolation and contact tracing. Those are the words that give me shivers about who gets to know your personal details about where you've been and who you've been with. And Trump said he's excited to announce that he's going to set up a new council, a task force of some kind, to decide on this whole idea of reopening the country. And you just cringe to guess who's going to be on that little committee. And we have some serious problems with the food supply chain because we have farmers who are dumping produce, milk, farmers who are not even picking crops that are now ripe, letting them rot on the vine or, on the plant. And this is what the agricultural credits or the bailout funds were intended for. But instead, a lot of that money has been given to prop up farms who've been hammered by Trump's ill-advised trade war with China and other countries. And now, if you like your pork and bacon, one of the largest agribusinesses in Iowa, I believe, has shut down because 200 of their workers have tested positive for the coronavirus. And we're told that our food supplies are all safe, that you can't spread it in that manner. But if you have sick people who are slaughtering the meat products that you consume? I don't know. I'd like to hear some science on that. Long wait for unemployment checks. In many states, you can't even get through on the phone. The websites crash. And it will be weeks, if not longer, before people start to receive those masks. Governor Don Siegelman, who you may recall, has been on this program many times. He served as the governor of Alabama until he was railroaded into federal prison by Karl Rove and their buddies in the corrupt swamp of Alabama. He sent a note over the weekend. As you may know, I served 5 years at the Oakdale Federal Prison in Louisiana. As we are here on Easter Sunday, inmates in jails and prisons are still in the crosshairs of death, even while the number of people hospitalized is leveling off. And he said the Wall Street Journal described Oakdale, which is where 7 prisoners have died. I believe that still is the highest number of any jail or lockup in the country. And he cites the Wall Street Journal. There's a reason. Oh, no, this is his quote. The living conditions are so cramped, inmates living one on top of the other, no protection, no privacy, communal showers, shared soap, urinals that are inches apart. There can be no safe separation. And when inmates are infected, it endangers staff, guards, their family, residents of prison communities. And I thank him for sharing his experience with that. And this is a sad story. In Brooklyn, on March 12th, there was a packed courtroom presided over by Judge Johnny Lee Baines. And some of the attorneys protested, saying, look, we can't maintain social distancing with so many people in the courtroom. And he said, if you don't like it, you can leave. And of course, that would put clients and pleadings at risk. Well, that was the last day that Judge Baines served on the bench. He died of COVID-19, according to the New York Daily News, 14 days later. And they've identified one super spreader. It is the pharma company called Biogen. And they had 2 conferences back to back. One was a leadership team of the top executives, and then they went to an elite healthcare conference in Boston days later. And they are now accused, or at least considered, to be a super spreader. And that Biogen employees boarded planes full of passengers, drove home to their families, carried the virus to at least 6 states, the District of Columbia, and 3 countries. Those are people who profit from the for-profit delivery of health care here in the United States. So Governor Cuomo said that he believes that the worst is behind New York. Quote, I believe the worst is over if we continue to be smart. I believe we can start on the path to normalcy. And then he said the worst can be over, and it is over unless we do something reckless. And you can turn those numbers on 2 or 3 days of reckless behavior. He said the number of deaths was basically flat, but flat at a horrific level of pain and grief and sorrow. And the numbers look like this. The state's one-day death toll of 671, reported today, is still horrific, but it's down from nearly 800 for the past 4 days. The number of patients on ventilators has dropped in 2 of the 3 past days. The number of newly hospitalized patients, just 1,958, was the lowest in the past 2 weeks. So this unfortunately raises a question. When Crown Prince Jared proclaimed at the only news conference that he's attended that New York was asking for too many ventilators, could he have been correct? Well, at this point it looks like it, but I think it's wise to wait and see. Today, we're releasing a fresh Peter B. Collins podcast that I seriously invite you to listen to. It's over at whowhatwhy.org. And my guest is Jeff Bell. If you live here in the San Francisco area, you might recognize him as the afternoon news anchor on KCBS. And Jeff has been quite public for many years that he struggles with obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. And in the podcast, he speaks to the extra stress that's on people who live with this anxiety disorder.
Obsessive compulsive disorder is a brain disorder. We know from PET scans and other forms of brain imaging that the OCD brain, if you will, is both functionally and structurally different from the non-OCD brain. So there is a physical component to this. That said, the OCD cycle, if you will, I think is very relatable for just about everybody. And what that is we have obsessions, and these are intrusive, highly disturbing thoughts that literally get stuck in the brain of somebody with OCD. And then we have compulsions that are these ritualistic efforts of ours that we take in an effort to try to dislodge that disturbing thought. So for those of us with contamination fears, the obsession might be, what if I get sick? Or in my case, what if I get others sick? I have what's often called reverse contamination obsessions. And then the compulsions, logically enough, would be to scrub my hands or to avoid contact with other people. Many of those behaviors that you're talking about right now that the entire country is taking on, and rightfully so. So what's confusing is those of us who battle the disorder are trained through therapy to stand up to our compulsions. So in normal times, if we are battling contamination obsessions, we would stand up to the compulsive urge to scrub our hands endlessly. Now, all of a sudden, we're being told, like all Americans and folks around the world, that we should be scrubbing our hands, as we should be. So the challenge becomes to follow the CDC guidelines as you are and not go beyond them right now. And so that in essence, is the most confusing aspect of this. There's also a positive side, though, too, if you will. And that is those of us who have been through OCD therapy have been given some tools that I think are very helpful for learning how to navigate uncertainty that perhaps the rest of the world hasn't been exposed to.
He also shares some of his own darkest episodes and how cognitive therapy and medication enabled him to live with OCD. So I think you'll find it very interesting and incredibly candid. Jeff Bell is a very honest man. The Washington Post has fact-checked the claims and the false hope promoted by Trump from his daily briefing podium that the drug hydroxychloroquine is a real game changer and that it will not cure but treat the impacts of the new coronavirus. And they go into great detail. They recite some of the comments that he's made. They take a look at the French researcher who Mark Crispin Miller was talking about in a recent comment that I quoted from him. But they do dismiss his findings. And there's also a new report in from Brazil where they have suspended a test project involving some 85 patients because of indications of a dangerous impact on the health of their hearts. So it's an interesting piece. Ultimately, they rate Trump's claims as four Pinocchios, which is their top award for what they consider to be lies. Over at the New York Times on Sunday, they went long, deep, and spilled a lot of ink to explain the failure in the early days of knowledge of the pandemic by Trump and his administration. And there isn't a whole lot of news here, but there's more detail. We know, for example, that up until mid-March, he was just downplaying the risk of the virus on Americans and on our healthcare system, and that the White House response has been generally chaotic. So I think it's worth reading. You can certainly find it at the New York Times. But as I say, it's not a lot of news. However, it became the basis for questions of Anthony Fauci when he trotted around on the Sunday political talk shows. And because Fauci said things like lives could have been saved if we had reacted earlier, he tries to dodge, you know, direct answers to questions about Trump, but he acknowledged that Trump delayed the whole discussion and ultimate announcement of social distancing measures and the related suppression and management techniques that have been utilized. And then Trump retweeted, here is the comment, Deanna Lorraine is the woman who ran against Pelosi, got 2% of the vote. By the way, Shahid Buttar, the progressive, who I really like, has run a spirited campaign against Pelosi, and he got 13% in the primary, and under our top two law, he will face Pelosi in November. But the Republican here, Deanna Lorraine, tweeted, Fauci is now saying that Trump, that had Trump listened to the medical experts earlier, he could have saved more lives. Fauci was telling people February 29th that there was nothing to worry about and it posed no threat to the U.S. public at large. Time to hashtag fire Fauci. And that's what Trump retweeted and the White House is in denial about today. But perhaps Fauci's biggest antagonist in the White House is Peter Navarro. He is nominally a trade advisor to Trump, and he loves tariffs almost as much as the Don does. So Navarro is parroting Trump, you know, you can't have the cure be worse than the disease. And they want to just, kind of irrespective of the cost in human lives and the number of people who would excessively become sick from the virus, to place the economy ahead of the human life. Navarro, it's disappointing that so many of the medical experts and pundits pontificating in the press appear tone-deaf to the very significant losses of life and blows to American families that may result from an extended economic shutdown. Instead, they piously preen on their soapboxes, speaking only half of the medical truth without reference or regard to the other half of the equation, which is the very real mortal dangers associated with the closure of the economy for an extended period. Well, I want to recommend a great expose on the early days of Peter Navarro, written by Carla Marinucci, who's one of the most seasoned political reporters here in California. And at Politico, she exposes what Peter Navarro was doing in the early 1990s, when he ran for office and lost five times between 92 and 2001. He ran for mayor, he ran for city councilor, county supervisor, ran for Congress. And they recall, Navarro's temper and ego often proved to be his undoing. In campaigns where he literally stood alongside Hillary Clinton, railed against Newt Gingrich as the personification of political evil, and positioned himself as a strong environmentalist and a progressive on social issues such as choice, gay rights, and religious freedom. And one of his political consultants, a guy who ran two of Navarro's campaigns named Larry Reamer, describes his former client as the biggest asshole I've ever known. He said, Navarro came on the scene as a disruptive force, a force of destruction from the progressive left. He tapped into something that was very strong. And he had been a Republican. Then when he ran for mayor, he was an independent. And then he switched to the Democratic Party. And he has reverted to Republican at some point before he joined the Trump administration. And Lindsey Graham is out there still. Bernie Sanders shut him down in the final debate in the Senate over the so-called CARES Act, the bailout for corporations that has a few crumbs for average workers. And at that point, Graham was objecting that some people would take the $600 federal bonus to their unemployment available at the state level and be making more money than they ordinarily would under their jobs. And he thinks that this would cause people to quit the jobs that they've been fired or laid off from in order to lay on the couch, eat Doritos, and binge watch the that Tiger thing. He is so full of shit. That's about all I can say. I do want to recommend, they published it Sunday. I didn't have room for it on Friday. But an op-ed in the New York Times by Bethany McLean, the author of Saudi America, The Truth About Fracking and How It's Changing the World. And she makes a very strong case that the oil war between Saudi Arabia and Russia, and as Scott Ritter pointed out in our recent interview that I know is unrestricted now at peterbcollins.com, that the real target is the frackers here in the United States. Because oil prices are so low that they can't make money and pay the interest on the huge debt that they've incurred. When oil is trading at $23 a barrel, like it is for West Texas Intermediate today. So this could be a silver lining. Of course, we'll pay for it because Trump will go to great lengths to bail out the oil industry, which already enjoys so many great subsidies that are uncalled for. So I recommend the piece. I think it is worthy of your attention. New York Times is reporting that conspiracy theorists in the United Kingdom have set fire to a number of cell phone towers in recent days. And they invoked the term conspiracy theory about six times in three paragraphs. They blame celebrities John Cusack and Woody Harrelson for amplifying concerns about 5G technology. And the New York Times, in this lengthy article, does not disclose its so-called partnership with Verizon, taking oodles of advertising dollars in exchange for promoting 5G. And there's a new book out that a number of listeners have tipped me off to, and it is written by Arthur Furstenberg. It's called The Invisible Rainbow: A History of Electricity and Life. And it's just a few days since its publication date. And I'm linking to a review from the Vermont Independent of the book and the questions that it raises. And Furstenberg goes way back in history to try to demonstrate that the various uses of electricity and electromagnetic waves, radio waves, over time, correlates with pandemics and other serious health events. Now, I think this is interesting, and to some extent it feeds a bias that I have against 5G technology. And I've started to read the book, and I've read this entire review of it. And at this point, I have to say that it is a kind of use of speculative correlation. And for example, he reveals history that I'm not aware of, that the so-called Spanish flu, which didn't come from Spain 100 years ago, coincided with an expansion of electrification. There was another wave when radar was developed, another wave when other deployments occurred of electronic and electrical devices. And I don't see him drawing conclusions here, but just using data and timelines to link these outbreaks to the deployment or the expansion or shifts in electrical tools and toys. So let me quote one paragraph here. This is from the review, not the book. Fast forward to the internet and cell phone era. According to Furstenberg, the onset of cell phone service in 96 resulted in greater levels of mortality in major cities like LA, New York, San Diego, and Boston. Over the years, wireless signals at multiple frequencies have filled the atmosphere to a greater and greater extent, along with mysterious outbreaks like SARS and MERS. Today, we face the installation of fifth-generation wireless, broadcasting in the gigahertz range, often at 60 gig, a frequency that is highly absorbed by oxygen, causing the O2 molecule to split apart, making it useless for respiration. So I think these are interesting claims. I'd like to see them researched, just like I'd like to see somebody besides the wireless industry research the human impacts of 4G and 5G. And I know anecdotally people who are extremely sensitive to EMF, radiation, including cell phone radiation. They say when they turn off their phone and put it in the microwave or the freezer, that headaches and other kind of symptoms go away. And when they turn it on and have it in their pocket, they do not feel well. And I don't dismiss those claims. I also oppose the way the Federal Communications Commission has authorized the industry to bulldoze local authorities with preemptive powers that allow them to put a 5G box wherever they damn want, to sharply reduce the compensation that local government gets for allowing the industry to put its wires on public telephone poles and other facilities. So there are good reasons to be wary of 5G. I personally wouldn't torch a cell phone tower. So Bernie Sanders went deeper today, and I don't know if you saw the clip from the Saturday Night Live without an audience of Larry David doing his Bernie Sanders impression and talking about how he doesn't want to give Joe Biden too much of an endorsement. Well, Bernie did. Quote, today I'm asking all Americans, every Democrat, I'm asking every independent, I'm asking Republicans to come together in this campaign to support your candidacy, which I endorse. We've got to make Trump a one-term president. I will do all that I can to make that happen. And I want to recommend to you over at Counterpunch a piece I read over the weekend by Laurie Dobson. And she is a very disappointed, hard-working advocate for Bernie Sanders. She supported him in 16. She supported him this time. Let me pull a couple of quotes. Bernie's always had terrible timing, a consequence of having bad advisors. He always seemed to be reluctant to agree to anything people were crying out for him to say, especially to stop calling Biden a good and decent man, his good friend, the party's only remaining nominee, an old man with a credible sexual assault allegation recently come to light, a serial plagiarist, a promoter of the worst policies the centrists had to offer. Bernie wouldn't fight back against Elizabeth Warren and her outrageous sexism charge. He wanted his kindly reputation to endure in a campaign that was not supposed to be about him. And my insertion here is that Bernie brought a butter knife to a switchblade competition. She continues, in the end, the campaign was all about Bernie. May not sound very charitable. I could not believe, however, that there were no admissions of any missteps in his concession speech, no mention he could have done more to address the concerns of many people. For instance, although he said he was inclusive, he didn't pay any particular regard to those not in the minority segments or youth age brackets he was trying to romance. He would not stray from the talking points hammered into our brains, trying to burn a legacy into place to make the case that he was the originator of these ideas. Then she goes on to say that the Wall Street transaction action tax wasn't his idea originally. Increasing the minimum wage was not original. But that Bernie adopted these ideas into the progressive platform that he ran on. Later, she says, I am not impressed that Bernie could not summon the willpower to respond to the efforts of those who wanted him to go to battle. I wrote many columns trying to appeal to him to suit up. I attended 10 of his campaign events in New Hampshire and wrote and made videos to support his efforts from the beginning of this second campaign. I've tried to reach the campaign to no avail, to urge them to heighten their response, sharpen their attack on substandard candidates' ideas. Bernie was staggeringly passive. He let one opportunity after another go whizzing past with weak responses, if any, in the face of a growing Democratic resurgence determined to destroy him. His silences emboldened the corporate centrists and confused supporters who thought he would take the huge advantage they gave him and surge forth. Instead, He endlessly equivocated. There's more to the piece. I'm also going to take up a postmortem of the Sanders campaign later this week in an interview with Norman Solomon, the progressive leader who also conducted a postmortem on the 2016 campaign. And there will be no holds barred. Finally, today, I want to recommend Alan McLeod's report over at Mint Press News, noting that on Saturday, April 11th, it was the 18th anniversary of the George W. Bush coup attempt in Venezuela that temporarily took down Hugo Chavez. And on the anniversary, coup specialist Elliot Abrams warned that if the current president, Nicolas Maduro, resisted the implementation of a transitional government defined by the U.S., his departure would be far more dangerous and abrupt, effectively threatening him with another assassination attempt like the one that the U.S. tacitly supported. That was the drone attack at a public speech in 2018. Thank you for joining me today for my news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the darn place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.